The one who bows and the one who is bowed to are both by nature empty. Therefore, the communication between us is inexpressibly perfect. Our practice center, it's a net of Indra, reflecting all Buddhas everywhere. And my own person reflects on the Buddhas to whom with my whole life I go for refuge. Offering light to the 10 directions, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, to whom we now bow in gratitude. Teaching and living the way of awareness in the very midst of suffering and confusion. Shakyamuni Buddha, the enlightened one, to him I acknowledge in gratitude. It's so good to be back here today. I think it's been almost a year. And I have to tell you that the last time I came, it was really a lesson for Tawari. Tawari had been bugging me for 3 months. She said, "Now you gotta just really teach something bombastic. You gotta be something really way off the charts. You gotta blow their mind." So I didn't. And so after we left that night, I said, "How was it, Tawari?" She said, "It was okay." And I said, "You see, now that was for you, because all the Dhamma has the same taste, you see. And if we get into the habit of wanting it to be expounded in such a mind-blowing way, then we make it pretty much like everything else is, you know, and we wrap our passions around it, and then it becomes something that we bring down into the mundane and into the ordinary. But when every word of Dhamma carries the same weight for us, then we have something that can mold us, that can craft us, and can utterly transform us. This is a lofty title for a retreat for this weekend, especially to like accomplish it in one day and 2 hours tonight and a half a day on Sunday, talking about we live in a shadow land of I consciousness. You know, and when I first heard this talk about the I, you know, and not me and not mine and not worthy to be called me, and I'm like, well, if I'm not me, who am I? You know, and so it's a very difficult concept to grasp. And then when I did grasp a little bit of it, I grasped it in the wrong way. And my teacher said, "Of course you're you." When I'm going around talking about non-self, such nonsense. But there is a space between here and here that we really do get it, we do understand. When we talk about coming to the middle way, it's not really like standing on the mundane ground and coming to some wishy-washy middle place, sort of hot, sort of cold, just sort of in the middle. But it's like coming to the tip of an apex and perching there and perusing the forest below, where before you couldn't see the forest for the trees. Now at this apex, you see it and you get it all together. You know, it's not this and it's not this, or it's this and it's this. And he says it's right there that you're perched at the doorway to entering into a space where the whole structure of appearances shifts for you. I love so much in the Visuddhimagga when they're talking about different types of personalities, and you know, that's why the Buddha gave so many teachings, you know, for all the different kinds of personalities and the different levels or aspects of view that we have within each personality. And he said, so I actually need to give something a little bit different for the person sitting next to you, because they won't quite get it, you know. And so so we have all of these different teachings, and we have all of these different methods. I love what the Apostle Paul said. He said, "I become all things to all people that I might win some." And so there, Buddha would sit and he would look and he'd say, now who in here is ready for the Dhamma? And he said he would peruse the crowd. And sometimes he'd just pick out only one. Oh, there's Subha Buddha. He's ready. And he would give a teaching. Everybody thought it was for them. But that's because they could get a little bit of something. But he said he was teaching to Subha Buddha. That's just, he was a leper. And he was sitting way over there because he was a leper. And he directed his whole talk. Now everybody got something, but it was directed towards him. Now we read it and we think, oh, like this is for all of us said in this exact way. And no, it's not. And that's why we don't always get it the first time, second time, hundredth time, sometimes never. Because in that particular way that it was given for someone or someone's in particular. Now we have the benefit, as good as it gets 2,500 years later, of maybe that's what he said. But we have the benefit of getting it and using it to the best of our ability. But the words were spoken, they were uttered for the liberation of someone in particular. And if we remember that, we will know how to approach the Dhamma, not in such a literal way that we become slaves to the words or to the law of it, but to understand that it was given to us, and to the extent that we can apply our strength, that we have the experience, the background, the rightness, the energy, the desire to awaken to something. Tissue, thank you. It's hot up here. Either it's hot or the Dhamma's hot. And we have the opportunity, by virtue of what we bring to the table, to awaken to something. This enlightenment factor of investigation is so important. And he said that it rides on the crest of the enlightenment factor of joy. I think sometimes as Buddhists, we kind of miss that one. Yeah. And we're trying to be the grown-ups in the spiritual house. And we miss it a little bit. But it's so necessary. Because it's what allows us to penetrate, in spite of the vicissitudes of life, it allows us to surmount, to mount up, to rise above these issues and come into our great wish, if we have a great wish. So he said, you gotta be ready for the Dhamma, you have to be looking for it. People ask me, how can you stand to be in, well, they don't ask me so much now, but when in the beginning when mostly nuns weren't really talking to people, you know, because that's why we went ascetic, you know, because we didn't wanna be doing all this talking to people. But people are my forest. So I was always talking, you know. And I said, well, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to give up this? And why would you want to give up that? You know, now I'm trying to lay a groundwork for the weekend when I'm talking about giving up the self, right? Okay. So he said, so why would you want to give up? No, I didn't give up anything. You know, I had done everything I wanted to do. I hadn't done everything that could be done, but I had done everything I wanted to do. So by the time, you know, I was ready to take this step, it was because I was finished with all that. If I wasn't finished with it, I would have stayed with it until I'm finished with it. So the question is, what are you finished with? So you can't, this is not a way that we break into the next door, that we bust through the next barrier. It's when a certain renunciation arises, when there is a tying up loose ends, a, a finishedness with something that we're able to get the pass go signal, that we're able to move into the next step. We can't get there through our usual means, our ways of being super achievers, and we're, you know, you can't, it's not that kind of energy that's required. It's the kind of energy when you're through with something and you're ready to let it all go, to lay it all down, and then suddenly there's this encouragement. But if you go just a little bit further, there's something different than what you had before. And so it's through the falling away of our excitement with something that we find ourselves posited at the doorway of something else. And we do have to apply effort to get there. Because this is like moving out from a shore, from a bank, into the middle of a stream. And when you're right there on that shore, I mean, you know, you're stepping on little pebbles or little shells, and you know, I mean, it actually hurts your feet. Can't wait to get out in the water because it hurts your feet. And that's how we come hurting. Can't wait to find something to take care of this pain. What is it? Emotional pain, psychological pain, mental pain, physical pain, whatever. Just looking for something, need something. And he says, it's good that you come, but you're not going to be able to find it in desperation. You find it in increasing steps of confidence, attainment, and then letting go even of that. So that's a different way to climb the ladder than what we're accustomed to. And so he says, line by line, precept by precept, here a little, there a little. And this is the way. And we learn how not to push, how not to crave, because craving is the builder of this house, this I-ness. Craving. And so he talks about different kinds of craving. He just talks about just general craving, you know. And he talks about craving for sense pleasures, like what we see and hear and taste and touch and smell and think. He includes thinking as a faculty or gate that is not, that is tied to something that comes from the outside. You know, like you said, this thought came to me. Well, if it came to you, that's a clue that it's not you and that it's not yours, it came. Now, I tell these stories sometimes because, you know, to know the Dharma is to know oneself. That's really all what we're trying to figure out here. Which self? That which is the very Buddha nature that has been obscured and clouded over by our long time wandering in samsara. And so there's this idea of needs and wants, which are endless, useless craving. You know, restless wanting, you know, rather patiently enduring. No patient enduring, just restless wanting. And yet we find that even when we get what we want, either then we want something else or it wasn't what I thought it was. I was fooled by something I saw or something I heard. Yeah, you know. For me, I wrestle with appetite. I like sweet things. I like salty things. So I could say for me, something I tasted. And we have to look and really know ourselves and want to know. Like something like too much information. I don't really want to know myself beyond. I'm a good girl, I am, you know. But it's really wanting to know what is one's propensities, what is one's habitual tendencies. Because when we know them, really, really know them, we stop blaming other people for making our life so miserable. We start to really realize this. It's me. I'm doing this to myself. But the gospel or the good news is, and there is a way of escape. That's what the Four Noble Truths, that's what it is. The truth of suffering. You don't say like, oh, life is suffering. I mean, we just took it from bad to worse. But it was just, can we just all agree? Can we talk? I mean, there is the truth of suffering. We suffer. And it has a cause. It's like, why is this happening to me? It has a cause. But we're confused because we can't see the cause. Or don't even know that there is a cause. I mean, even when it's something good, no cause. Miracle! And that can be so unreliable. You know, you may be in good graces or bad graces with the gods. You may, you know, be on the corner of 6th and Vine and you're supposed to be on 15th and M because that's where they're giving out the goodies. And like, you might have got the call late, the signal crossed. You know, so it becomes so unreliable. And we already know that. Even when we found something that does give us a sense of comfort and confidence, the minute it is outside of ourselves, unreliable. Or at least it sets up a dynamic where I have to make sure I'm pleasing you all the time to get what I want. And so we have this exchange. And we have the reasons for the exchange to make sure that I get what I need. And our relationships are all based on that. You like them me, I like them you. Something like that. And he says that when we rely on these external means to know something, we will be fooled because we can't know it all together by through those external appearances. And we all know we have seen something at one time and we thought it was something that we thought up in our mind or manufactured in our mind or our friend whispered about, you know, yeah, they hooked up. I mean, we make an assumption based on a momentary observation, something that we seen, yeah, or something that we heard, something that we thought based on an experience that we had and it turned out this way, so when they do that, it's gonna turn out that way, or something that we haven't heard, well, I never heard of it before, I never heard of it working out either, or I just don't understand how that's gonna pan out. And by the time we mix it up with our experiences or the experiences of others that we have heard about, that takes on a different quality. We're not seeing it in the conventional sense as it is, much less in the ultimate sense. And so we jump into these studies and we're going for the goal, you know, this intellectual understanding. And when we think we've grasped it, you know. But that is not the thing. That is not, if I read about freedom all day long in a prison cell, I'm not free. So it's not reading about it. It's not thinking about it. I wrote down a quote from Jack Kornfield. He said, the real world is beyond our thoughts and ideas. We see it through the net of our desires, divided into pleasurable, not pleasurable, right, wrong, good, bad, inner and outer. So, but to see the universe as it is, you must step beyond the net. And that's not hard to do because a net is full of holes. And so the Buddha's talking about entering into this world that's beyond our thoughts and our ideas. We can't take them in there. And yet, there is a there. There is a something. But our words, I could tell you all day long when I was married about my husband, but you would not know him. You gotta know him to know him. You know? That says something about him. But you gotta know him to know him. And so life is like this. And Dhamma is like this. You have to experience it to know it. And so this illusion of I is rooted in seeking meaning in things of who and why. But the Buddha said we're asking the wrong question. It's not so much about who or why, but how. How does this come to be? How does this come to be? How? So if in every situation that came up, whether it brought you joy or whether there was some suffering of with it, some sorrow, a present, apparent sorrow, instead of asking, why is this happening to me? Suppose we just inquired, how does this come about? He said, if we started asking that, we start loosening a little bit from this sense of this egocentric sense of life, that like I'm at the center of the universe, my universe, and everything is rotating around me and mine, because we see the end result of that. If we look back over our life, we see that that hasn't been a very good way to look at things. And it doesn't matter how much money we have. It doesn't matter, you know, like how many degrees we have. It doesn't matter about all of those, any of those things. Yet and still, I live with myself, and I am my biggest Waterloo, because I'm with me 24/7. I see me all together, but I don't really know me. I don't really understand why I do some of the things I do and why I don't do some of the things that I want to do. The Apostle Paul said, you know, I have this war going on all the time. The good I would do, I don't do. What I don't want to do, I do. Oh, wretched man am I. Who can deliver me from this? Well, the Buddha had already given. I said, how wonderful that we found it. But a key alone is no good unless you put it in the lock. It's got to be the right lock. The right lock in the right door. You know, opening to the right space. Otherwise, the key is just a key. And so he says that a slight shift in our inquiry, and I love it so much, because we're like a school of fish right there. You ever watch a school of fish? I just want you to catch the beauty of what I'm able to observe right now. But we're like a school of fish, and we're like moving just like this. And I switch up, and you switch up, I switch up, and you switch up, and I see the rapt attention. And it allows us to cut through ignorance, cut through non-understanding, regardless of what kind of personality or propensities that we have. And I could tell that you were listening when we talked about it being able to, like, just swim right out of the net, because the net is full of holes. In the Vasuddhimagga, it talks about one of a hating temperament and one of an understanding temperament. And you think these are two totally different kinds of people. One of a hating temperament, one of a understanding temperament. 180 degrees apart, but he says, no, you got it all wrong. It's this, they're this close. They're actually very similar. Only difference is that one of a hating temperament condemns living beings. One of an understanding temperament condemns mental formations. Just the thoughts that create harm, but not the people. Now, if we could just get that, what a wonderful world it would be. We could use a good dose of that, a strong dose. We could, like, just pass the bottle around tonight. Because right now, you know, some of us have friends that we can't even talk to right now. You know? Because our views about some things right now are so different. We're so divided around our views of what's beneficial and not beneficial, what's good and what's bad, what's right and what's wrong. And we think that this is so bizarre, but the Buddha said we live in a particular world where we have different minds and different bodies. So how do you expect us all to agree? He said, it is not possible. So I already know that. How can they think like that? Different minds, different bodies. And we form our opinions based on different things, or maybe the same criteria coming from different places. I had to give a talk last week, and to prepare, a week before last, and to prepare for this talk, I listened to a radio station. I don't listen to the radio, but people in my small town do. And we only have one kind of, so you either listen to the radio or you don't, you know, because just one favorable to one party. And I listened to that talk radio all week. The first day, I was so upset. And I'm yelling at the radio, you know. That's who I'm talking to, the radio. He's the only one there with me. I'm yelling at the radio, that's not true, and how can you be so blind, and you're just wicked, wicked evil. And I made a lot of runs so that I could listen to the radio and wouldn't give away my, nobody would peek my whole card. I didn't know how, this was an experiment. I didn't know how this was going to turn out, you know, because I do know me. And so I was constantly running out so I could listen to talk radio. Whew. And I said, Panyawati, you have work to do. Because as long as it was like a little bit further away, as long as I could like incline my mind to something that's beneficial and useful and lovely and of a good report, there's any virtue, if there's any merit, think on those things. You know, however, you know, wherever, however the mind inclines, that's the way we go. And it's a practice that we do. We do this practice so that we can maintain peaceful minds and steady minds. I mean, that's how mob mentality comes from. Like, we don't know where our mind is, and it like just goes with the flow. So it's like, just keep that. So this is a good quality, it's a good practice. But it showed me something that I still had some work to do. By the second day, I was no longer yelling at the radio, but I had a cross, you know, opinion, a cross argument for everything. By the third day, I recognized even when I agreed, I would not agree because of who they were. By the fourth day, it was obvious to me that I was caught in the same craving that they were caught up in. It. And the Buddha said that, you know, the hardest thing for us to give up, I mean, we have a hard time giving up anything once we have possessed it, but the hardest thing is our opinion. Because our view, giving up our view, is so hard because that's me. That's who I am. And I could see more than them having a hard time giving up their view, I saw that I had a hard time giving up mine. By the fifth day, I got that back in check. It was a good view to have, that one that I have. But what I realized was that was my view for me, where I stepped across the line was insisting that it become their view, you know. If I was skillful, maybe I could persuade, because they formed an opinion based on some experience that they've had in life that tells them this is the right course of action, or that tells them at least that I have witnessed is not. Misinformation believed becomes the truth for that one. And so I began to see suddenly what I thought was so personal, how impersonal it really is. And once I could move it away a little bit like that, I started coming up with ways that, arguments that I could give, apologetics, ways that I could explain it, and first acknowledging that that truly is their map of reality. It's not a good one, but it is one. And that's one way to think of it. Here's another way to think of it. And suddenly, all of the anger and the rage that I had was gone. It did not require the efforts of anybody else. When I got back to Heartwood, and right away, a sister came running up to me. She said, I was talking to my son, Panyawati, and I just had to get off the phone. I can't even talk to him right now. You know, and I could comfort her. I could tell her to go back again. This time, really listen to what he'll say. Don't come up with your argument. Just listen to him. Find out where you think the view may be off, and then find a way through skillfulness. Yeah, it may work and it may not work. And the Buddha said that's what you get in this world, because there's no security to be found anywhere. And if you're looking for some, you're in the wrong world, because it's not here. But On the other hand, we are the world. And so what we see playing out is a reflection of people like me and people like you. And the only way to be different from them is we got to be different. Have to be different. That's the starting point. And to be different, it means that we have to awaken through contemplation of how things come to be. And redirecting that inquiry allows the stilling of thought. You would think it would be a proliferation of thought, but proliferation of thoughts comes about through our very confusion. You know, like when you don't know what to do, what direction to take, like, and you're thinking, this could happen, this could happen, this could happen. I think this happened, I think this happened, I could be wrong about that. And then before you know it, you've just come up with 15 different possible scenarios. And like, so if she says this, then I'm going to say that. And then when he does this, then I'm going to do that. You know what, I bet you right now they're trying to do. And we have this whole proliferation of thoughts, this thicket of views. But he said that when we redirect our inquiry to asking how and then sitting with it, not asking and answering, but asking and sitting in that stillness, our intrinsic nature begins to emerge. Because the mind is like, if you could imagine a pond of water and you got that stick and you just are stirring. You're stirring it up, stirring it up, stirring it up. And you look and your reflection is all distorted. The water's all muddy. It's like constantly another thought, dropping another pebble, another rock, and whoosh, dispersing the water. And the image is unsteady. But when you let it all just sit, the dirt, the silt just goes down to the bottom. The ripples waft away. And you have a still, smooth lake. The mind is like this. And the closer we come to stopping the thinking, making the inquiry, and then stopping the thinking. Sounds like an oxymoron, but it's not. That is the process. Making the inquiry, and then knowing that, rack your brain as you might try, that anything you come up with based on the senses, something you've seen, something you've heard, something you've tasted, something you've touched, something you've smelled, and something you've thought, it's not going to give you the whole picture. Trusting that that's the process. I don't know if you've done that. Have you done that? Because that's the process. He said, but there is this place then that we're coming. That's why he teaches concentration. But it's not the kind of concentration that we think of as concentration. That's why we don't even use the word that much. We think about mindfulness, you know. We think about mindfulness, and we think about, like, just watching where the mind is going. But if the mind's over here, then the mind's over here, then the mind's over here, and I'm watching the mind, I'm just watching. I'm over here, and I'm over here, and I'm over here. But when he talked about developing a kind of mindfulness that's based on concentration and the stilling of all thought, he gave us a different process. And if you read, like, in the Nikayas, particularly the Najima Nikaya, and I like that one because it's called the middle length discourses, and we just think, like, the the Dharma talks that are offered, they're not too long, they're not too short, they're just right. You know, the Dhammapada has a few lines, you got to unravel that too much. You get into the Digha Nikaya, it's like it goes on and on and on and on. Like, what were we studying here? You know, but the Majjhima Nikaya is just right. You know, each Dhamma talk is a few pages, you know, and it's just compact enough, but yet expansive enough that you can really come away with something good. And he says, in 98% of the suttas that talk about meditation, and that's almost all of them, 98% are around concentration, because it's the concentration that informs our mindfulness. And he said, like a sawyer saws a log. And although he goes back and forth with the saw, his eyes never leave that single point where the teeth of the blade meet the wood. So we're not following in this sense. You know, not really noting the arising of this and arising of that. I mean, it is there and it's truly noted, but our focus is like right there and it's not moving. Training the mind. It's like training the puppy to the paper. We get that. The puppy runs off, we bring him back, put him right on the paper. Runs off, bring him back, put him on the paper. You know, tweak his belly a little bit. And then he starts to get the idea that maybe I'm supposed to do something right here. And he'll tinkle a little bit. And that's great. Then you start moving. That paper might be in the bathroom. You got to get him outside. So you start moving the paper. He follows the paper. He goes right there to the paper each time. I don't care what else is around. His single focus, looking for the paper. And you can get that paper over to the door. Now you got him at the door. You put half the paper outside. We used to race dogs. We used to breed dogs, my husband and I, so I was an expert on this. So you get, then you have half of the paper outside the door so that he can't like make his three turns and squat. He needs more space. So then he starts scratching at the door, you know, howling a little bit, saying, I need more paper. You know, and we'll open the door and put the paper outside, and he goes there. Then after a while, we take it over to the far end of the grounds. And then you don't have to be cleaning up dog poo all over the place. He just goes right there to the far end. You just got one spot, all your dogs. How wonderful it is. And so it's like that, training the mind. You see, this is a technology, this is a methodology. It's not rocket science, but it feels like rocket science to us when we get it right, you know? Because there's that release. There is that mental release, you know? Yes, something is happening. Something's happening in the world. Something's happening in my world, you know? And it's not always gonna feel good. It's not going to always be the right thing, the beneficial thing, or the useful thing. So then what are we going to do? Just going to go off and kill 10 people? No. When we have to have developed the stability, regardless of which wind is blowing, whether it's praise or blame, loss or gain, pleasure or pain, fame or shame. Because these eight, this is our world. This is this world. This world that's impermanent. Everything is constantly changing. By the time you see the change, nobody even stopped that puppy most of the time because it's so subtle and it's always moving. So while I'm rejoicing over something that has come, it's already in flux. It's in movement already. Before I can usher up the laughter, it's already moving. I'm a diabetic, and I'm, I just like ice cream and cake and chocolate bars and, you know, all these kinds of things. They're not good for me. And I've done a lot better just because I want to live and don't want to chop off my feet, you know. But I tried to ask myself, what is it in ice cream that would make me eat it at the risk? You know, every family member diabetic. I didn't hit mine until I was 60. I was bragging, I'm not getting it. Because, you know, whatever the mind, but it's not just the mind, you know. And watching them chop off my family members' parts, feet and legs. And I had one family member, he was just a torso in the bed. I remember one time going in to see him in the hospital and the stench, gangrene. I said, John, you got to go. I said, there ain't no house not fit to live in. You just have to go. I said, I'm not coming back here to see you again. I had to teach him how to let go, to just go. So I wonder, what is it about ice cream that can make me like it, and like it like I do? Knowing what the situation that I'm in. Well, I'm still asking myself that question. I am. But you know what? I'm not expecting anybody to take care of it but me. I'm not expecting anybody to do anything about it but me. Doing it at my own pace, and maybe that'll be fast enough. Maybe it won't. But what I can say is, well, I might not have the ice cream under control, I'm getting the Dharma under control. And some things count more than others. You know, it just depends on where we want to put our attention, because that's an important one. If the body's not here, then I don't think I could do much more work on this side, right? And so, but to just look at things in a very as-it-is way, that's what I mean. And having the ability to do that. And recognizing that sometimes you don't really get it. You don't really get it until it becomes your experience. I was on my mother all the time. It doesn't even make sense. You could take care of that with diet. You know, you don't have to shoot yourself up with needles. And you don't. And I was on her all the time. But you know what now? I get it. If you don't have it, you can't tell me about it. But I get it. And in my own time, I'll decide what I do with that. And there ain't no point in nobody being sad about it. I'm not even sad about it. But I do understand cause and condition. One time the monk there at the Hermitage was he's so still, Panyadipa, he's so still that I'm like, you know, you might just stop by reason of stillness. I said, I understand stillness. I said, but you know, I shouldn't have to come knock on your door to see if you're still alive. If you're alive, you should show some sign. You have to, you know, you have to move. You have to move. You know. He's like, well, when there's something to do, I do it. When there's nothing to do, I don't do anything. And I said, yeah, well, I'm gonna be just like you one day. Right now, there's something, and so everybody just loves him. They said, oh, Panyadipa, he's so still. You know, he's so, oh, Paniwadi, you should be like that. I said, if I was, you wouldn't know about it because this Dharma Center wouldn't be here because he's not going to start anything. He's not going to initiate anything. If something's there, he's going to go with it. You know, however he can help, that's fine. If you need him, he'll move it, he'll do something. But in terms of initiating something, it's not. So it takes all kinds in this world, yeah? Yeah, so just don't think. I don't think that the Buddha meant for us to be like a box of vanilla wafers, all lined up, you know, all looking alike, talking alike. I don't think so. But starting from where we are, with our own personalities, our own propensities, our own views, we have to find some way that we step outside of this I-ness so that we can see our commonality, that maybe we're just all viruses in one body. You know, I bet you a virus doesn't think, a virus probably thinks he's an individual being too, just like we think it, you know? Because he can't get the big picture, you know? But there's this way that we can come to know that I am the very stardust itself. And he teaches us with such simple methodologies. So he has us observing. We're going to do it in our meditation tonight. Because I don't know if you've done it this way or not. But tonight we're going to do something a little bit different. And he says, and although there's movement, we don't follow it. We find one point. And as that movement crosses that one point, that's when we become aware of it. And wherever it goes, that's where it goes. If it comes back and it crosses that point, we see that, and that's it. And we just stay right there, right here. He said, like a gatekeeper. So then people come from far distances, but he doesn't watch them approaching the gate. He only observes when they step from outside the gate to inside the gate. That's his job. And wherever they go once they're in the city, he could care less. Training the mind to be that present with an object. But the thing is that once you train the mind that way, that mind becomes present. Period. It's training the mind to become present, not in the past, with worry, with regret, not in the future, with anxiety and with fear. Just in the present moment. And even to be able to be in the present moment with its unpleasantness and its pleasantness. And there's something so empowering about that. It says that there is a confidence that arises, that there is nothing that this world can bring. There's nothing that it can throw your way that you cannot handle. Number one, you start to see the characteristics of this life and everything in this world, that nothing is permanent. There's no security to be found anywhere. So we stop looking for it. And we show up with what is present. Fully there, fully focused, fully ready to step into the fray. But we can do it with the ease of knowing that it's no way that it could be happening except the causes were put in place to create that condition. All conditions are due to causes. We may know what it is, we may not know what it is. You know, but if I found myself in a hole, I don't have to think, now, how did I get in this hole? How did I get in this hole? I'm in the hole. What's the next step? Figure out how to get out of the hole. Put all your energy there. No need, the past is gone. The past only exists in the present moment. That's why we say there is no past. You gotta understand what some of these things mean. Like, there is no past. The past is gone. The only past there is whatever you think about in the present moment, that according to how you put things together, happened in the past. That's it. So there's no point in really thinking so much. So when we talk about how did this come about, we're not talking about like really, like she said this and then I said that, then she said this and then I said that, and she said this and then I hit her, and this is how it happened. It doesn't mean like asking how in that way. How do things come about? But it's recognizing cause and condition brings us right here. What do we do right here, right now? How do we cultivate and use skillful means in this moment? And you have to be able to put all of your attention right there on that. If you don't, you'll waste your time, you'll waste other people's time, and you'll never accomplish what it is in your heart to accomplish. You won't have the strength, you won't have the tenacity, you won't have the courage, you won't have the interest, you'll be weary, you'll be tired, and you'll be deluded, and you'll be forgetful hearers. But when you sharpen the mind in this way, and that's what this practice is about, then you'll be equipped and ready for every good work. I am renovating a retreat center. It's hard work too. But what I know is that I have to be fully there with it. Because every day, I mean, it just gets ridiculous. Every day, there's an obstacle. Now, I hear some good news at 10 o'clock, bad news at 11, some mediocre at 12, bad at 1, some all right at 2, bad at 3. I mean, if I'm stacking it up like this is bad and this is good, the odds are going like this, you know. Nevertheless, I'm not discouraged, not in the least bit, you know. I'm like, because if that's one person's view, the city, you know, they think, oh, they're going to make money. So then the city wants to annex me. And that means like I'm paid, you know. Then they want to tell me what I could do with the place after you already bought it, after it's halfway renovated, you know. Then they want to, I mean, and it just goes on and on and on. I mean, they're not used to anybody. They told me when I came there, you know, they say, we don't know you, we don't know what you're about, but I tell you this, we don't like Yankees. We don't like people from the North. Nobody black runs anything in our town, and you're Buddhist, and we don't know what that is. And so they had already let me know, you know. I'm like, okay, but, you know, that's all right, because I know me. I know what this is. And so I can just work according to what I know. And in time, they'll get it, you know, or not. But I'm sure I'm supposed to be there doing that. And so you do what you are allowed to do, what you can do by reason of strength, and you never become discouraged unless you're confused. And so I work through this every day. And so as soon as I hear some good news now, I don't even break out in a grin. No need, because all I got to do is give it about 45 minutes, and I'm gonna get another phone call about something. You know, and so, and now it's like I just take it all in stride, You know, I'm not even afraid to answer the phone. I look and see if I recognize the number, unknown number. This is somebody I don't know. Why would they be calling me? You know, and answer the phone. I'm calling from the so-and-so department. I'm calling from, you know, and I'm not afraid to answer the phone. Because whatever they say, you know, I'm like, okay, I'll sit with that. And I'll call you back and let you know what I'm going to do. And I do. I sit with it. And I find all kinds of ways of escape. It's amazing. It's uncanny, you know. Even people who don't like me, but I know they don't like me because they don't know me, because to know me would be to like me, you know. Especially if we like passing each other. I'm real good at just passing, you know, passing knowing. Now, if you have to spend a whole lot of time with me, you might beg to differ. But just in passing, I can give anybody a smile. You know what I'm saying? I can give anybody the benefit of the doubt for at least 15 minutes. And so for someone there to not like me, I mean, it has no basis in reality. You know? So I don't have to worry about that. But it is wonderful after you've been struggling with someone with who you don't know why they don't like you, you know, and then suddenly there's a breakthrough. And it came after I went to her and said, I said, you know, I don't know what I did to you. I said, you have had it out for me since the day I walked in. She said, oh, no, I have. I was, yes, you have. You have. I said, that's okay, though. What I want you to know is that I'm not offended by it because I practice. I know you don't know what that is, and that's what scares you, you know. I said, but I really do. And that was it. Now when I go in there, hey, Panyawati, you know, and she's so helpful to me. You know, but I just broke down that fear. I just faced it. And she doesn't have to like me. She doesn't have to like me. But if she knew me, she would. And I wanted to give her the opportunity to know me. That's it. But I had to go a long time being hated on. Long time. So we have to have the endurance, the patience. But we can do that when we know ourselves. Now, if we know, like I'm worth hating, you know, then you have to work on that. I see things about myself that, Panyawati, that. You know, like you over here, you know, playing with that, that's where you need to go. That's what you need to work on. And this kind of practice allows us to do that because there's a difference between shame and a sense of moral shame. A sense of moral shame is like recognizing your own great wish. You know, it's recognizing that that you can do better. That the notion of doing better is in you. It's just a little hard in the moment because of that egoic influence, you know. And I would think, like, you know, if I, what I'm thinking right now, I don't even want you to know. So I might just give you a smile. And I do. Because that's one way I neutralize the things that I think that are not worthy of me thinking them. I don't frown all up and cover my head with a blanket. I just look at them. No, you don't even know what I'm thinking. But it's probably not something about you. It's something about, you could do better than that. That's the best thought you could bring up. Yeah. And so in this way, we start looking at ourselves, looking at this false self that we've crafted around certain ideas or expectations or needs. You know how the person, we have a court jester in our city. So they thought I was going to be like him, but I'm not, you know. I'll smile, but I'm not going to dance and do a jig, you know. But that was his way of coping in a sort of hostile world, and that's what they came to expect, And you know, so here comes one thinking and doing, not dancing a jig, and they're like, that's out of character. What's with her? You know, and I have to show, you know, like, we come in all sizes, all shapes, all types. We do all kinds of different things. That's all. You just haven't seen one like this. You know, and that's it. So I don't have to feel anything because I have no expectations. When we come into a sangha, I've heard them say, oh, I don't feel safe. I don't feel safe in this sangha. I don't feel loved. But when I come to the sangha, I'm coming to offer safety. I'm coming to be a harbor or a refuge for someone. I'm coming to love someone. You know. So I tell them, well, you know, like if you want to be loved and you're waiting on somebody outside to love you, you might never know love. You better have enough for yourself. And actually, you'll find that you have more than enough. And you have some for somebody else. Yeah. They could just teach by example. Yeah. And before you know it, I gets off. It abandons. It abdicates its throne. And you find that life shifts for you. And nobody's done a thing. You did it all by yourself. And then when he starts teaching these deep things that we like to talk about deep, but we're not deep, we can really authentically go deep. And we can we break through to these fundamental understandings of the nature of life. And we become happy being here. They called his disciples the happy ones, not because ignorance was bliss, but because they really understood the intrinsic nature of things, that all things are impermanent, that all things are empty of any inherent fixed nature, that everything is the result of things coming together to create something. And you take one of those ingredients out, the thing changes. And all of it, or none of it, I should say, can totally satisfy. So if I'm not looking for that kind of total satisfaction, when it doesn't come, I'm not disappointed. It's just kind of correcting the view. And when I'm not disappointed, then I am at peace. What destroys my peace is the sense of disappointment. What destroys my peace is the expectation that I have. And so this is a training in abandoning the demand for things to be the way we want them, and accepting in the sense of acknowledging how they are. And so tomorrow, we're going to go into two aspects of training. One is a discussion around effacement and reflection on effacement. The other is meditation, bhavana, mind training. Two very different things. One is finding the sweet spot, knowing how to incline the mind with applied and sustained thought, no matter whatever else is coming and going, learning how to let it just roll. When it gets here, you see it. When it gets there, you don't. That's it. And the other, no, the Buddha called that a pleasant abiding here and now, the one that trains the mind to incline in a certain way. The other is a discussion around effacement. Effacement means like rubbing out. And it's the effacement of self, the rubbing out of self. Now he says that only happens with people. When I'm here, I have a confession, because I tell you the thing about being a teacher, and I'm almost through. The thing about being a teacher is that you have, at least with the Dharma, it forces you to practice what you preach, because it'll put it right up there in front of you. So I'm on the plane today, and the reason why I tell these stories, I get these emails from teachers to say, Pani, why you shouldn't tell your personal business like that? Because it causes the people to lose confidence. I said, no, they didn't have any confidence in me, and they weren't coming to get any in me. They were coming to get some confidence in themselves. And so sometimes we have to know how to examine things, how to look at things, how to work with something. So I tell these stories so to give you an idea of how you can work with yourself or face yourself or challenge yourself or, without hating yourself or having a sense of shame about something. And the more you do it, the easier it becomes to just quickly, turn on that light of discrimination, because there's no judgment with it. It's just discrimination. And then after a while, you won't need to discriminate so much, because you'll have come into that middle place, where you're not leaning too far to the left and too far to the right. And so I go to my seat, and I'm in my seat. Great. So then this lady comes in, and she tries to get in her seat, and she can't get in her seat. And so she says to the flight attendant, the seat's too small. She said, can I sit over there? Now, it's the same size seat. Can I sit back there? And the flight attendant says, I think that's a good idea. The reason she thought it was a good idea is because now the lady wouldn't be in the aisle, kind of spilling over into the aisle, because, they need to be able to move up and down the aisle. So she puts it over here on the next row next to me in an empty seat that's by the window. Stay with me. The story's almost finished. By the window. I just need to do the right setup. But as she got into her seat, only half of her could get in the seat. So she had to have the armrest up so that she could, use part of my seat and one leg in my chair. And I take up my whole seat. And so it wasn't working for me. If it had been a short haul, from North Carolina to New York, I could do that, or to Chicago. But I got to come all the way from here all the way to there. I said, it's not going to work for me. I'm not going to be able to do it or be any good when I get where I'm going. I'm already in physical therapy. And so I asked her, could I move to another seat? Fine. She could say that she could have both seats. I need to have another seat. So she tells me, go sit over there then. So I go sit over there. Well, at the last minute, a lady comes running on the plane, and that's her seat. So then they tell me I have to go back to my seat. So I said, well, the problem with that is that I only have half a seat now. So he says, well, you can't just get up and go sit in any seat you want on an airplane. I said, I know that, sir. I said, the previous flight attendant told me. That's what he did to me. Just dismissed me. He didn't want to hear. Now, and then her husband got up from, they weren't seated together, and he came and he sat in that seat, which he should have done from the beginning. But he did. All right, and so that was the end of it. But I'm going to tell you, the whole rest of that flight, I was working with that issue. Now, it wasn't that I was upset. Okay. I was a little bit upset. I was a little bit upset with the flight attendant. He was rude. He was dismissive. and he was not helpful. The operative, you know, word is attendant. And he wasn't attending, you know. But it wasn't that as much as I felt bad that there had been a little bit of a scene. And it highlighted that the lady was obese, you know, because that's what it was all about, taking up, I mean, literally 1.5 seats, you know. But I thought about if it was me, what I would have wanted, how I wish the conversation could have been approached that maybe would not have made me feel a certain way about myself, you know. I could have taken 2 Tylenol when I got here, you know, if I was in pain from being cramped up, you know, and the mind comes that way because the mind is a protection for us. It's like, Paniwali, you don't feel bad about that. That was just wrong on so many levels for you. Yes, maybe so. But all I was thinking about was if I had been her, knowing that she has difficulty. So the mind starts saying, well, then that means you got to buy the upgraded seats that give you 3 more inches or something like that. The mind is always doing that for us, you see. Your mind is always coming to your defense. But the awakened mind leaves us without needing a defense. It puts us in that impartial place that we can choose what is the right course of action for the one who needs the grace. And I would have not wanted to be embarrassed in that way. And her husband, to try to save some of her embarrassment, I like the guy. He was a little slow thinking, but I like him. He immediately got up from his seat and he came and he took that seat. And he's a big guy too. And I felt sorry for the third person because he was like this, you know. And I'm thinking, better him than me though. He's young. He can handle it. But you see, but my thought really, and I'm making a little joke about it, but I'll tell you, I really thought about it. And I asked myself, I said, the next time I would at least try. I didn't even try. I just right off the bat said, no, done this too many times, that's not going to work for me. But I could have tried. I didn't even try. Who knows? And so this is what the Dharma asks us to do. And that when we really consider the other, too late for me to do anything with that now. You know, so there's no point in getting into regret about it. There's no point in like flagellating myself, beating myself up. And, you know, it's not even evaluating it right or wrong. It's just asking the question, you know, what could compassion, more compassion for her in the moment have done? But I don't know, but I ask myself that question because the next time, hopefully not on the way back, the next time I will really consider it. You know, I didn't want to be a forgetful hero. I didn't want to like let it fleetingly go across my radar. I sat with it for hours. There's nothing else to do on the plane. I sat with it for hours. And I know because I sat with it, I reminded myself how important it is. You know, the practices that I do, and there's one called Roll All Blames Into One. That when something goes wrong, regardless of whose fault it is, Will you bear the infirmity of the weak? Will you take it on? It's not like lying. It's about setting up a certain attitude to be able to go further than we go.